Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good day. In September 1970, two boys met in the playground on their first day at secondary school in North London. They form what would be described at the Old Bailey 30 years later as a unique and wicked bond. Between 1982 and 1986, striking near lonely railway stations in London and the home counties, their partnership took them from rape to murder. Three police forces pooled the resources to catch them in the biggest criminal manhunt since the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry. A Dangerous Place is the first full-length account of the crimes of John Duffy and David Mulcahy. Told by the son of one of the police officers who led the inquiry, exhaustively researched and with unprecedented access, this is the story of two of the most notorious serial killers of the 20th century and the times they operated in. It is the story of the women who died at their hands. It is the story of the women who survived them and who had the courage to ensure justice was done. And it is the story of a father told by a son. The book that we're featuring today is A Dangerous Place, the story of the railway murders, with my special guest, journalist and author, Simon Farker. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Simon Farker.
Not at all. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, all the way from London. Let's talk about how you came to be involved. We alluded to it that this is the story of your father was one of the officers involved in this incredible case.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you came to be involved and wanted to be involved in writing this story, A Dangerous Place.
Well, my father died in 2013, and naturally when you lose a parent, you want to do something in some sort of tribute, some sort of gesture. Strange enough, it never actually occurred to me to do a book about this case or anything. What happened was that a short time later, I was writing a piece for a newspaper. There was a television show in Britain in the 70s and 80s called Police Five, and it was a weekly show where they appealed for help on unsolved crimes. And while this case was going on, my dad appeared on that program. And when the host of it was a guy called Shaw Taylor, who was very well known in Britain, he died not long after my dad, and I was writing a piece about him for the newspapers. And as a result of that, I happened to be in discussion with a publisher, and was telling him about my dad's connection with that program, that he'd gone on there to appeal for information about the railway murders and so on. And I was talking about my dad's part in what was an enormously important case, and he just said, "This is fascinating, why don't you do a book about it?" And it's kind of obvious, really, but it had just never occurred to me. And initially, I was a bit unsure because it wasn't a genre I'd ever explored before. But then I thought about it a bit more, and I thought, well, it's strange that a book hasn't been done on this case yet. So if I don't do it, someone else probably will. A lot of documentaries have been done on it, but never a book. And I also thought, not only would it be an interesting opportunity to pay tribute to my dad, it would be an interesting way of understanding who he was as a working man. It would mean talking to his colleagues, going through the, you know, visiting the places he had to go to, putting the story together from his point of view. So it just became kind of irresistible after that, actually. And then the first sort of tentative steps I took were to try and contact his colleagues in the case. And immediately they came back with so many stories, and I realized that a lot of the coverage of the case in the past had been quite superficial or had been quite a lot of inaccuracies in it. So after that, what actually happened, and I suppose what often happens with stories like this, very dark ones, is they begin to take you over a little bit they become, you know, they haunt you sort of day and night. So it became quite a compulsive experience writing it. So yeah, that's how it came about.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's talk about the principles in this, because we have so much to cover in this incredible story. There's so many twists and turns in this. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about John Francis Duffy, which was born in 1958. You say he's the eldest of three children. Tell us about his upbringing in this family with
John
Wilhelmina
Duffy
and
was. That's right. John Duffy was the son of an Irish couple. He was born in Ireland, and the family moved over here in his childhood. They were a very decent, hard-working Irish family. His father was a builder. They quite religious, not massively so, but they were sort of dutiful Catholics. And as a young child, we know very little about him that suggests there was anything sort of wrong there. As he began to grow up, there were certain things about him. Right? He was very, very short. He was long, well below the average height. Even as an adult, he never got taller than 5'4", which, you know, drew attention to him, and he probably got teased a bit because of that. He had a very, very bright ginger hair as well, which got him a lot of attention at school and a lot of bullying and things like that. But he came, as I say, he came over with his parents to live in North London. And he wasn't gifted academically, and he wasn't really, he was a child that wasn't really interested in anything. Nothing could engage him. He wasn't interested in anything at school, sport or academically, anything like that. But when he was 11, he went to Haverstock School in North London, which is today quite a respected school, but at that time was a school with a lot of problems. It had a very bad record for discipline, bullying and that sort of thing. And he arrived at Haverstock and was bullied very, very mercilessly. And one of the things that he used to do was he would put on a heavy overcoat with a hood, and he'd wear it the whole time, even on hot summer days, as a way of sort of hiding from the world, you know. But on his first day at that school, in the playground, on the first day, he met another boy, David Mulcahy, and from then on, his fate was sealed. Together, that partnership began. So that was it. Duffy was raised as a Catholic, and what obviously becomes, without wanting to jump ahead too much, what does become important later on in the story is that Duffy's decent upbringing and religious upbringing and so on never quite vanished, despite the dreadful crimes that he was led into. Much, much later, something of that came back, as we will see.
You talk about Duffy meeting David John Mulcahy, and you talk about him being a son of a garage mechanic turned pub landlord, and he was born a year after Duffy in 1959. Tell us what their early relationship was characterized by. What did David Mulcahy become, in essence, as a friend of Duffy?
Well, I think what happened was that Mulcahy was also bullied at school and isolated, so therefore these two boys were sort of thrown together. And they had something in common in the fact that they were both from Irish families, which was, you know, just a bit of a coincidence. But David very quickly grew into a much bigger lad than Duffy, and a bit more confident and arrogant. And I think after a while, he kind of enjoyed the role of being Duffy's kind of protector and his sort of leader. Very quickly, they both completely disengaged from their school life, so they began to just not go to school, and they spent a lot of time just wandering around North London. Very near to their school was Hampstead Heath, which is a massive great area of heathland in London, which is full of lonely places, which they enjoyed skulking around in. And they started experimenting with petty crime. I mean, if children aren't going to school, they need to do something to occupy those days when they can't, you know, hang around at home or anything. So they started a little bit of petty crime. They would do little bits of vandalism. They'd start fires. They would do little bits of damage, little bits of theft, and that sort of thing. But what was really crucial at this time as well is that in Britain at this time, there was a real fascination amongst a lot of youngsters with martial arts. This was the age of the Kung Fu craze and Bruce Lee and so on and so forth. And these two boys got completely fascinated by this, probably as a way of trying to feel more confident with the world around them, take some revenge on the fact that they'd been victims of bullying and so on. And they started to train, and they started to really immerse themselves in a kind of martial arts philosophy, but a very skewed version of it. And they would endlessly practice moves. They would pretend that they were soldiers or whatever, and sort of, you know, have these imaginary games. But it began to take on a more sinister edge. They became completely detached from the world around them and operated in their own little bubble. They hardly interacted with anybody else, and they were heading down a path. Mukahi wanted to see himself as what he called an immortal warrior. You know, it was immature, it was tomfoolery, but at a late age. The other thing that they would start doing as they became adolescent, as they became sexually aware, is that they would pursue girls in the playground or whatever, and then when they grabbed them, they would touch them inappropriately and that sort of thing. All things that these days you would hope a school would notice and would, you know, would look into. But in those days, you know, things were far less policed than they were. So by the time they're in their mid-teens, you have already a history of petty crime, a fascination with martial arts and violence, and an aggressive sexual attitude. They had no interaction with girls. They both, by the time they left school, they had no qualifications at all, and really had just, they had become complete outsiders. But their relationship was something that was entirely, there's an expression, folie à deux, the madness of two people. And that's what this really sort of became. They knew each other inside out. They had their own little world, which no one else was really privy to at all. And unfortunately, they were now on a path towards becoming killers.
You talked about their foray into petty crime and the escalation of that, and their interest in martial arts and then violence in general, and that they would begin to stalk women. You also talk about on spring break 1977, Mulcahy met Sandra Carr, who was 16 years old, and the following June, the couple were married. Duffy had found work as a carpenter for British Rail, which, again, this will be very important. Go ahead.
They both, by the time they left school, they both, as I said, had no qualifications, and they also had no experience of the opposite sex at all, apart from in an aggressive way. Mulcahy began working behind the bar at his parents' pub and tried various things. He showed some aptitude as a decorator and as a plasterer, but he never really was able to stick at anything. This is actually quite a common trait, I think, with serial killers and things, is an inability to settle into any kind of occupation or commit to anything like that. Duffy showed some flair as a carpenter, and he got an apprenticeship, but he wasn't kept on after he completed it because he was so regularly absent. However, he then did manage to find work working for British Rail as a carpenter, and this allowed him free travel on all the rail networks in the home counties and in London. So he built up a very, very good knowledge of the railway very quickly, and I would imagine that David would have probably travelled with him quite a lot. In the evenings when they were probably hanging around or in the daytimes, I would imagine that they probably both travelled on Duffy's free pass, just wandering around and gradually noticing that the railways are a very good place to use if you want to attack people, because there's so many lonely spots, you know, especially in those days before there was CCTV and that sort of thing. It's an absolutely perfect opportunity for people to operate like that.
You talk about Duffy also meeting a woman, Margaret Byrne, and they married in secret due to their parents' disapproval. And you talk about
that's right.
The...
Yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention about the marriages. Yes, they both married the first women that they formed any kind of relationship with. Mulcahy married a lady he'd met at a dance in 1977, and Duffy, a year later, met a nursery teacher called Margaret. And both of those marriages did appear to settle the two men for a short time. So we're talking by 1978, they're both about 20 and they're both married. And for a short time, they both appeared to settle, have jobs and so on. Mulcahy and his wife had children. Duffy and his wife couldn't have children. And by the early 1980s, both marriages appeared to have been... There's possibly a bit of crisis in both of them. I think David was possibly bored, restless, and so on. Duffy, on the other hand, it appeared that he wasn't going to be able to have children, and this became a serious challenge to his sense of masculinity.
Around this time, you talk of a plan that these two hatch. What is that plan? What are they? What do they try to do?
Well, it dates back to something which had happened earlier. The summer they left school, the summer of 1975, the first job that Mulcahy got was doing some decorating for a woman in a house in North London. Something happened, and he had an altercation with this woman. I think she didn't pay because I think he hadn't done the work adequately. And he just went crazy about this. And he said to Duffy, she needs teaching a lesson. So they broke into the house while she was out. They broke in through a skylight, and they waited there with the plan to rape her when she returned. But she just didn't come back, and they waited and waited and then decided they couldn't wait any longer, and they left. But an idea, I mean, we will never know what would have happened if that woman had come back at this point. But the following year, it happened again. There was a lady in Kensington who Mulcahy decided was stuck up, to use his term. So they broke in again with a plan to rape this woman. And she did return, but she returned with a boyfriend. And the two of them ran very quickly out of the house to avoid getting caught. And they found the whole experience exhilarating. They found that the lying in wait and the preparation was a level of excitement they'd never experienced before. So if we move forward 6 years, and we don't know of anything that happened in those 6 years after that apart from some petty crimes and burglary and so on. But in 1982, Duffy's marriage was in real crisis, and his wife was going away for the weekend on a course. And he and David hatched a plan to kidnap a woman and torture her over the weekend. They were going to abduct her, drive around London blindfolded, take her back to Duffy's flat. He'd even got a mattress prepared in the living room to keep her tied up on. And they would do various things. They were planning to walk her across a roof blindfolded to the edge and all that kind of stuff. And again, it didn't happen. They just, when it came to the crunch, they just felt they didn't quite have the, they didn't dare do it. But again, the seed of an idea had formed, and they, you know, it was another step towards committing an actual crime of this nature. So on the next occasion that Duffy's wife went away, they decided to try again. And this time they broke into the back garden of a house in Abbey Road in North London. Abbey Road, famous for the Beatles album. And a lady who lived in a flat on Abbey Road was just going to bed. She turned the light out in the living room and she saw a man standing on the balcony who was Duffy. She rushed to open the door and scream across the garden, and she heard a second man saying, quick, let's go. And this was them, and this was the last time they were thwarted. They were angry because they were so close this time and they'd been thwarted. So then they decided that the third time they weren't going to miss the opportunity. So in June 1982, one Saturday night, they went out in Mulcahy's car, drove around for hours, and then finally saw a young girl walking along Hampstead Heath very late, and they they accosted her and both raped her, and then drove back to Duffy's flat in a high state of excitement, going over what they'd just done. This was one of the things that they loved. They loved talking about their crimes afterwards and comparing notes and deciding who will we get next, what sort of victim will we choose. It was an unbelievably the complete disregard for human feelings in it. It was quite remarkable. But from then on, it became a compulsion, and it just became more and more frequent over the next 4 years.
With these attacks, there are descriptions of these perpetrators, and as well coverage in the newspapers. What did that do for their confidence, or were they hesitant? What did that do to their MO?
Interestingly enough, they actually rather fed off that publicity. They saw it as a bit of a game. I mean, Duffy said later, we saw it as a game with the police. We never thought we'd get caught. They kind of enjoyed that sort of cat and mouse thing. One of the things that these two men went to extreme lengths to try and avoid being caught. They would wear masks or balaclavas or hoods. They would talk in accents which were different to where they were actually from to try and confuse the witnesses. They would drive around normally in a car, but then they would park it some way from where the attacks would take place. Mulcahy would put tape inside his jacket, and then he would use that to put over victims' eyes and mouth and that sort of thing. It was planned with a militaristic precision, and they would carry either knives or replica firearms with them or whatever. But although initially the publicity sort of excited them and they enjoyed outwitting the police and so on, there did come a point when the attacks became so prolific that the police started to put them all together. I mean, at first, they didn't know. You know, the police didn't know. You have a random set of attacks taking place over a period of time in London with descriptions which are vague. You don't know for sure that they are connected. Once they were connected, then posters started going up searching for the North London Rapists, as they were known. And on one occasion, they were driving through London one afternoon, and they saw one of these posters outside the local police station. So Mulcahy got out of the car and looked at the poster, which had some artist impressions of the two men on it, and got back in the car and said to Duffy, don't worry, it doesn't look anything like us at all. But they realized that they were now attacking so much in the same area that they had to start moving further afield, which they did. And they then started moving further away from the area of North London they'd normally operated in. And around this time, I think it becomes obvious that Mulcahy decided that it would be better if they didn't start leaving witnesses alive, or victims alive, after they'd finished with them. And gradually murder became more and more inevitable.
You talk about this escalation, but you also talk about this becomes important later, but John Duffy's marriage, what was it characterized by in that four-year period? What did his wife notice or experience in that four-year period?
Yes, indeed. She described it later as a four-year journey from him going from a reasonable man to a madman. He became more and more violent towards his wife during that time. He initially, the violence was within a sexual context. He became more and more aggressive during sex. The violence then began to spread out into domestic violence of all kinds. And he would start to replicate some of the things that he was doing with David towards the victims. For example, he would tie her up. She couldn't believe how quickly and how adeptly he could do this, because he'd had so much practice at it by now. He would gag her, all those kind of things. It was all another way of kind of reliving those experiences. And the violence became known to people living in the same block of flats as them. You know, they could hear the noise, they would see the effects of it, and so on. Until eventually his wife did leave him. And when she left him, he just went absolutely berserk. And he then, over a period of time, she met someone else who Duffy found out about this, and then tracked them both down and attacked them both. He was then reported to the police, and he was put on a restraining order where he wasn't allowed to go near his wife at all. He sexually assaulted her at this point as well, and the trial for that was delayed and delayed, and it was during that time that the murders took place. I think he probably knew by then he was probably on borrowed time, because the police now had his name on file. You know, if he hadn't committed those offences against his wife, I dread to think how much longer this could have gone on for, actually. But he was becoming so out of control now. And the other thing that's important at this time is Duffy also started attacking alone as well. We don't know that David McCarthy ever did that, but Duffy did start attacking alone. And when he attacked on his own, he was careless. He didn't go into it with the same kind of level of detail and preparation that they did together. So he would leave much more clues, much more forensic evidence, and so on and so forth. So gradually, a more and more clear picture was building up for the police.
You talk about John Duffy is also at this point, at some point, missing work and staying home. What does he miss work to do at home? And tell us some of his interest and what happens finally with his job at British Rail.
Yeah, he. But by this point, he was kind of immersed, retreating more and more into his own sort of fantasy world. He spent a lot of time watching violent films. He was obsessed, as I say, with martial arts. Interesting, that was something that David McCarthy had lost interest in by now, but Duffy was still obsessed with that. McCarthy was much more sort of fickle with these kind of interests. So he would stay at home all day just watching violent movies, particularly ones that had, you know, kind of violent towards women in them, also watching violent pornography and that sort of thing. And he was building up quite a collection of weaponry by this time as well, from various underground shops around London. He was buying sort of knives and koshies and all that sort of thing, and martial arts magazines and various literature. There was a particular book that he and David read at this time called The Anarchist Cookbook, which was which had been banned on and off over the years, an early 70s book. And that had all kinds of things in there, and techniques on how to garrote people and how to overpower people and all that sort of stuff. All of this was just feeding, you know, this sort of compulsion that he'd discovered. Eventually, his absences got to the point that he lost his job at British Rail. And that gave him even more time to just wander around the railway network. And 1985 rather, was his most prolific year in terms of attacking on his own. One thing I don't know, actually, I've never managed to find the answer to this. I don't know if David Mulcahy knew about him operating on his own. It's an interesting thing, because it was Duffy acting on his own which brought the police closer to them, and so he would have probably been pretty angry about that. But I don't know if he ever did know, actually. I think he probably didn't. But Duffy, by this point, obviously was not able to control this, unlike McCarthy, who was always very very careful, very deliberating in this sort of thing.
Obviously, the police are looking for these rapists. What is the characteristic of the actual attacks, and what do police find in terms of any kind of forensic evidence at any of these rapes? Are they going on, and what do they know, and what do they think?
Sure. Well, you have to remember at this time, of course, that there's two huge problems for the police investigating attacks like this. One is the fact that it's very difficult to get victims to come forward. A lot of women attacked like this don't want to report it. Particularly in those days, there weren't the things put in place there are now. It was all rather primitive in the way that rape victims were dealt with by the police. The other thing, of course, is at that time forensic science was much less sophisticated than it is now. This was before DNA. So all that the police really had on that regard was blood grouping. That's pretty vague science. So what they had, the characteristics of the attacks were, they were stranger attacks. They were normally committed around railway stations, most of them committed around North London. It was always two men, a taller man and a shorter man. They didn't know much about the taller man, but the shorter one was very short, and he had an A secretor blood group. The shorter man would often engage the girls in conversation. Sometimes what he said to them was deliberate disinformation to throw them off the scent. He would say that he'd just come out of prison or something, which none of that was true. The shorter man would often apologize after the attack. The men would normally steal something from the victims, often a house key. One of the things that was very significant is that they would ask the victims their names and addresses and say, if you report this, we will come and find you. Sometimes they would steal things which had the address on. For instance, they would steal a library card or something like that. So obviously these women were absolutely terrified by this. So they were the main things. For the taller man, what they knew about the taller man was that sometimes he had difficulty in carrying out the attacks. Sometimes he suffered from impotence. He also had a sort of slightly darker complexion. He was about 5'11" and was much more violent than the shorter man. And as the police began to put the attacks together, they noticed that the violence was visibly increasing. And what appeared to be the case was that the taller man was using the violence as a reaction to his impotence, and it would often cure it. There was one particular attack on a 24-year-old au pair, and the taller man couldn't get an erection, and he ordered the shorter man to mutilate her horrifically. And actually that threat suddenly changed everything, and he then proceeded to rape her. And so I think McCarthy, by that point, you know, realized that violence was the real appeal to him in this, and domination. It's an interesting thing as well that many years later, when Duffy confessed to these crimes, he actually talks about this quite a lot and says that although initially it was the waiting and the planning that was the appeal of this, for David, it became more and more about domination. And Duffy actually said his eyes were ablaze when he was doing this. He was a totally different person. And I've actually listened to that interview tape with John Duffy saying that. And even at a distance of all those years, you can still hear a slight sense of surprise in his voice at just how possessed at these times Mulcahy became. So they were all the kind of characteristics that the police had. What they had to go on in terms of, they had some descriptions. Obviously, the men wore masks and stuff, but occasionally they would, witnesses saw them without them and so on. What they also had, as I say, was the fact that the shorter man was an A secretor blood group. And there's various other little things, like the taller man had a mole on his chin, he had dark brown hair, that kind of stuff. But it was very vague. It was very, very poor information. And what obviously became most significant later on was that on one occasion, these two men actually attacked two women at the same time. And this was the attack which became crucial to the whole case. And this attack took place in the July of 1984 on Hampstead Heath. And this was two Danish girls, two 18-year-old Danish au pairs. They'd missed the last bus back from central London and were walking back, and were walking along a long road by Hampstead Heath, which was a very busy road, even at that time of night. There's plenty of cars going up and down it. Duffy and McCarthy had been driving around that night, constantly searching for a victim, and hadn't had any success. And they saw these two girls, and they pulled over a bit further up the road and discussed whether or not they would try and attack both of them. So they did. So they used to pose as joggers doing this, so with their tracksuits on. So they ran up behind them and bundled them down off the road onto the heath, and raped them both. That attack was crucial because it's the only time that they had, uncorrupted evidence, forensic evidence from both men. And that became very significant, obviously, many years later when DNA technology had come in. At the time, it wasn't a great deal of use at all because neither man had any history of this sort of thing at that point. There was nothing on file that connected them. It was very vague. The more crimes that were committed, the more information the police were getting. Another thing that was a telltale sign which allowed them to connect a lot of the cases is that these two men also carried tissue with them, tissue paper, which they kept inside matchboxes with some matches. And what they would do is they would give the tissue to the victims after the attacks. tell them to wipe the forensic evidence away, and then they would set fire to it in front of them. And that was partly, obviously, to try and avoid any forensic detection, but it was also a kind of psychological torture of the victims, sort of saying, and we've left no trace behind, you know, that sort of thing. It was, I think it was as much a psychological torture as a piece of forensic evasion.
Now, you talk about acceleration, escalation. You talk about January 26, 1985, and 20-year-old German au pair was blindfolded at knife point. And tell us about these crimes and how frequent these next attacks are after January 26, 1985.
Yes, the January attack was a significant one. It was a particularly horrific attack on a German au pair who'd only been in England, I think, about 8 weeks or something like that. And there was a lot of reasons why this attack was significant. One was that as well as the violence increasing as these attacks went on, the other thing that started to increase was the sort of psychological torture of the victims. So that initially they would abduct these women and the attack would take place and then they would run very quickly. What started to happen was they would abduct the victim and then take the victim a considerable distance before the attack took place. They enjoyed that long, drawn-out process of having to lead them off somewhere further and further away from civilization and reducing the victims to a state of abject terror. Now, this was an example of that. This lady was... this was in an area called Brent Cross, which is where there's a very big shopping center and a lot of roads intersecting. So you've got huge, great flyovers and things like that. It's a kind of concrete jungle. So this woman was taken, abducted there, and she was walked a very long way down to where the river is. And the victims would often be stripped completely naked, no matter what time of year or time of night or whatever like this. It's all part of that, reducing them to a state of complete helplessness and vulnerability. And during that attack, Mukahi actually, again, he said to her, "I want your name and address," and all that sort of thing. It was a horrific attack, and that lady was so traumatized. She did initially try to fight them off. She had an umbrella with her, and she tried, but it was all completely, you know, to no avail. From then on, the attacks in 1985 noticeably become very pronounced in their violence and in their protracted kind of quality. There was an attack on Hampstead Heath in the summer of 1985, and when this girl was abducted, the taller man, Mukahi, was constantly screaming and screaming at Duffy, "Stab her, stab her, stab her," all the time. On another attack at this time, Mukahi became so violent with the girl that Duffy actually pulled him off and said, I think someone's coming. He said he was actually getting alarmed at how violent David was becoming, because Duffy's motivation throughout this was entirely rape. That was entirely what the attacks were for. With Mukahi, it was becoming something a bit different by now. So through 1985, there was a real proliferation of attacks, to the point that on one occasion there was three attacks in one night, which I think showed these two men at the height of their, not only of their evil, but their arrogance as well. Three attacks within a very short space of time, I think within 3 hours or something like that. So at the end of the summer is when the posters were going up for the North London rapists, and that's at the point when they made the decision to cool off for a bit and then move further afield. And the next thing that happened was their first murder.
You talk about at that time, as a result of the three, especially the attacks, three times in one night. Interestingly enough, it was July 13th, 1985, Live Aid concert in Britain and America.
That's
you
right.
You say that
that's
the press
right, yes.
had dubbed them the Spiders, but an operation, police operation, was codenamed Operation Heart, began also using a Mica computer, a Mica computer.
Mica computer, that's right, yes. That's right, yeah. Operation Heart was set up after the three attacks in one night. The police by then had managed to put together something like 24 attacks that they felt sure were committed by the same one or two men. And Operation Heart was set up. It stood for Harley's area rape team. Ian Harley was the officer in charge of it at the time. And it was set up from a huge incident room in North London where every bit of information was put through a computer, a very primitive computer at the time. And a series of appeals took place. The police appealed for any other women who may have been attacked in these circumstances to come forward, and huge numbers of women came forward. Not all of them attacked probably by the same two men, but obviously if you've been attacked by a stranger and you fear that he's still out there somewhere, you would want to hope that that something's being done to find him. So as I say, although computers became very important in this case, it was very early stages of that. And the computers weren't talking to each other. What they were really useful for was collating information and making it easy to access information at one point. In the book, I drew a comparison quite a lot with the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry, which had taken place 5 years earlier, which was a disastrous inquiry in terms of the fact that everything was still done manually on paper. So at the end of that inquiry, the police had something like 2 million statements from witnesses. So if someone came forward and said, I think I saw the attacker and he had blonde hair and a moustache, they had no way of cross-referencing all that. They had to go through everything manually. Whereas with a computer system out, they could just put those details in and it would throw up every single statement which mentioned one of those things. I mean, this is child's play now. This is the basic function on a Word document. But in those days, it was revolutionary, you know, and enormously important when you've got an inquiry which is so far-reaching at the time. But Operation Heart was running from the summer onwards, and it ran for just under a year, and was no closer to finding these two men. But there was one very important thing that Operation Heart did, which was because the one thing they knew was that the shorter man had an A secreted blood group, Operation Heart ran a check on every single man in London who had an A secreted blood group, who had a conviction for a sexual offence. And they came out with just under 2,000 names. And it was simply a case of working through them one by one. John Duffy was number 1,595 on that list. So, you know, everyone has to be worked through. So they began working through it, and they got to Duffy the following summer. But what's also important to know is that Operation Heart, within about 10 months, was actually due to be closed down because resources were very tight and it didn't appear to be making any progress. In fact, it was making very good progress, but it hadn't led to an arrest, and it was very, very close to being shut down when, thankfully, a breakthrough was made.
Tell us about the breakthrough that continued this manhunt, that continued this investigation, and the role your father has in this situation,
sure,
in this investigation at that time.
Well, to do this, I suppose we should first just mention, we should talk about the first murder that was obviously about to happen. So we go to Christmas 1985, and there's been nothing heard from Duffy and Mulcahy for a few months at this point. And Duffy spent Christmas with his parents. Mulcahy spent it with his children. His wife was away visiting relatives in India. And on the 29th of December, in the early evening, Mulcahy phoned up Duffy and said, "Let's go hunting." This was their regular term that they used for going out and looking for a victim. They called it hunting. What they would do is they would drive around in David's car and they would play music to psych themselves up. Their favorite track to play was Thriller by Michael Jackson. And they would sing along as they were, you know, scouring the streets looking for a victim. Anyway, Duffy had arranged to go out with his parents, but he made an excuse, got changed into darker clothes, and Mulcahy picked him up, and they took Mulcahy's children to their grandparents, dropped them off there, and then started to drive around looking for a victim. As far as Duffy knew at this point, they were looking for another rape victim, and that was all he knew. They drove around, and this was the Sunday after Christmas. It was a very, very cold night, and also it had been a long Christmas holiday that year. By the way, that Christmas Day fell. So therefore, most businesses didn't go back to work until the following Monday. So that Sunday night in London was a quiet one. There was lots of lonely places around. They followed along the North London line until they came to Hackney Wick, which was at that time a very run-down area, which was mainly warehouses, factories, and so on, a lot of which were empty by this time. They parked up and they waited at Hackney Wick station. It was an area that they'd already recced and knew was a good place for an attack. And they waited, and unfortunately, 19-year-old Alison Day stepped off the train to go and meet her boyfriend, who was working at a printer's around the corner. She was going to keep him company because he was working overtime. And they grabbed Alison. She came off the train and took her to a concealed area. One of the things particularly terrible with this is that apart from all the other indignities that Alison suffered by them, it was their most, up to this point, their most extreme kind of torture, psychological torture. To get her from the railway station down to under the railway bridge would have been a simple enough case of walking her out of the station entrance, but instead of which they walked her across the live railway tracks and down the embankment and under the bridge. There she was raped by both men. And then, in Duffy's mind, the idea was to take her back across the bridge and leave her on the other side of the river and then make their escape. But Mulcahy decided instead to make her walk along the ledge on the outside of the bridge at knife point, which on a freezing cold night, it was impossible. So she fell into the water. And as she fell in, she screamed out that she couldn't swim. Duffy managed to pull her out. And as soon as he did, she ran for her life, with absolutely no idea where she was going. She didn't know the area at all. And this absolutely enraged Mulcahy, the fact that a victim had defied him. This was something that happened quite a bit in the attacks as well. If a victim tried to escape or defy him, that would normally set him off into a complete frenzy of violence. So he yelled out to Duffy to get her, and he used Duffy's first name. And I think he probably did that deliberately to give him an excuse to turn to murder. They captured Alison, Mulcahy rapes her again, and then they led her across playing fields and tortured her and then killed her. And Mulcahy killed her using this extraordinary method, which he'd gleaned from martial arts books, which is called a Spanish windlass. What that basically is a piece of wood put into a knot in a rope and then twisted so that you get an enormous, big, tight grip on something. It was a martial arts method. And he then handed it to Duffy and said, "We're in this together, you do it too." And then Alison was rolled into the river and they fled. And Duffy went back to join his parents at a party. He was panicking about what they'd done. And Mulcahy said it had to be done. We would have been done for attempted murder anyway. The murder of Alison Day was an enormous news story at the time. Alison Day lived very close to where we lived. She actually had gone to school with my brother, actually. And she was missing for over 2 weeks before she was found. And in that 2 weeks, there were enormous appeals in the press. And the following Sunday after the murder, there was roadblocks set up outside the local station. You know, did anybody, have you seen this girl, and so on. And the case was being run by the local police. They had very little to go on. There were no eyewitnesses, nothing like that. And then after Alison's body was found, the only thing that the police had to go on was this very unusual murder method. Because she'd been in the water for so long, there was no forensic evidence left at all. The inquiry was run on a very low budget because at that time, police resources were drained very low. There was a very big strike action taking place by newspapers in London at this time, and it was called the Wapping Dispute, and it drained a lot of police resources. So there was very little money, and the inquiry was being run on a shoestring, basically. And after about 3 months, the officer who was running it was moved off to do something else. And my dad, who was based at that station, who by this time had been in the job for nearly 30 years and had a really good record as for solving murders, was told to take the case over. And he was told to take the case over and wind it down because it wasn't getting anywhere. But what he did was, rather than just say, "Okay, I'll do that," he spoke to all the all the troops on the ground, so to speak, and said, what do you think we should do? And they all said, we don't want to give up yet. We just need more resources, that's all. So my dad went back to his superiors and said, we want to keep this going. And it was constant pressure. We can't afford it. We have to close it down. And eventually, my dad said to his superior, if you want to close this inquiry down, you can do that. But you can be the one that goes and tells that girl's parents because I'm not going to do it. And thankfully, within a week of that, he had made the breakthrough, which led this to become the biggest criminal manhunt since the Yorkshire Ripper. It was that close to being closed down. I'll remain forever proud of him for the fact that he refused to give up. He had a real bulldog quality like that. So the breakthrough that he made was that he started a second wave of publicity, which generated some kind of interesting information. But the other thing that was important was that he wanted to have a check done on any crimes that had been committed near railway lines, any kind of sexual crimes that had been committed in the last year. And inevitably, the Operation Heart attacks came to his attention. The other thing that he noticed was another crime that was committed a few months after Alison's murder, which was the murder of a 15-year-old schoolgirl about 30 miles away. And for some reason, this intrigued him, and he just wondered if it could have been the same man or men striking again. So he phoned up Surrey Police, who were looking after this inquiry, and asked how the victim had been killed, and they said, she's been strangled. And my dad said, well, our victim was strangled as well, but there was one peculiarity, which was that this tourniquet method of murder had been used, this Spanish windlass. And the officer from Surrey said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, it's a piece of wood put into a rope and twisted. And there was a silence on the phone, because what the Surrey police had actually thought was that when they saw their body with rope around the neck, the piece of wood had fallen out of the knot and was lying next to the body. They hadn't connected it. And then they suddenly realized that's what the piece of wood was doing there. It had fallen out of the knot in the rope. And they said, look, I think we've got the same man. I think this is the same case. So what with that connection and with the connection with this Operation Heart series of rapes, they suddenly realized that was it. And then they pulled their resources. So this went from being an inquiry which was being run into the ground to being an enormous one with, you know, massive amounts of resources put into it.
You talked about the incident that your father linked and made that crucial mm-hmm. link and discovery
yes.
and kept this inquiry going and alive. You talk about April 17th, 1986, and if I
yes.
mispronounce her name,
yes.
Marty Tambozer.
Marty Tambozer, that's
about
right.
This incident.
Yeah. Well, Marty was the second girl to die at their hands, and it's an awful tragedy. I mean, Marty was 15 years old. She was a Dutch girl. Her parents had come over to Britain because her father worked for Shell, the oil company, and he was based here. So they lived in a very beautiful village in the Surrey countryside, a very affluent part of England. And Marty was a very happy child, very shy. And quiet, and quite young for her age, very protected, but happy and very studious. And on the 17th of April, 1986, Marty had been at school for the day, and she came home from school and was very excited because that weekend she was going on a school trip back to Holland, and she wanted to buy some English sweets to take back to her friends over there. So when she got home from school, she had something to eat, and then she said to her mum, I'm going to go and cycle down to the sweet shop. And her mum said to her, that's fine, but always remember, take the main road. Don't take that little path along the railway line. There is a path along the railway line in this village, which the locals, it's a local beauty spot. But Marty's parents, being good parents, said, don't take that on your own because it is a bit lonely. Marty being, you know, like any other child of that age, said, yes, of course I won't do that, and then did. And unfortunately, she took that railway path, and Duffy and Mulcahy were waiting for her. What had happened was that because they'd realized that by now the attacks in London were being connected, they decided to go even further afield. And Mulcahy had found this location in Surrey, by the railway line. How he found it, we'll never know. He visited it a few days before Marty's death and lurked around on the path and jumped out on an old lady and frightened her. And this was him just sort of rehearsing, you know, how good an ambush site is this, what are the escape routes and so on. So they came back on the afternoon of the 17th of April and saw Marty cycling along towards the sweet shop. They watched her go, and then Mulcahy said, "What goes up must come down." In other words, she'll be coming back in a few minutes. So they tied a tripwire across the path, and then they hid on either side of it. And as Marty came back, she stopped her bike, puzzled at this tripwire, and that's when they grabbed her. And from where that happened, and if you actually go there, where Marty was abducted, it would take you about 5 seconds to then take someone into the trees and be hidden. But they didn't want to do that. They decided to walk her almost a mile just to protract that torture. So they walked her around the perimeter of a field, through the woods, into another field, all the way around the edge of that field, and then to almost a point where beyond where the eye could see. And then Mulcahy said, "This will do." Duffy raped her while Mulcahy kept a lookout. And then something curious happened. Duffy then got Marty up to lead her back and realized that Mulcahy had vanished. Mulcahy had gone back to dispose of Marty's bicycle, and he'd got trapped on the way back because a woman walking a dog had seen him. So he was hiding in a field. There were quite a few people around. It was a popular dog walking area, so there were a lot of descriptions of him. Eventually, Duffy saw him waving across the field, and he gestured to an area of concealed woodland, and they led Marty in there. And when they got in there, for some reason, Mulcahy just went absolutely into a frenzied state and began to attack Marty and hit her with a rock, knocked her unconscious. And interestingly, at this point, there doesn't appear to have been any sexual assault. I think for Mulcahy by now, it was all about violence and wasn't about any sexual gratification at all. So he then ordered Duffy to strangle her, saying, "I did the last one, you do this one." And then they split up, having stolen the money that Marty had on her. And they then walked back to the railway station, but then Mulcahy went back to the body and attempted to set fire to it to conceal any forensic evidence, and then rushed back to the station where he was seen by a lot of people in the village. There was very, very good eyewitnesses saw him, and got on a train back to London with Duffy. And Marty's parents obviously were frantically not knowing where she was. She was missing overnight. The police were called. The neighbours were searching the woods and so on. And first thing the following morning, two men in the woods found her body. And Surrey police arrived at the scene. And in the words of John Hurst, who was the officer who led the Marty Tambosa murder, he said it was probably the worst murder he'd ever seen. It was a savage, brutal attack. And the amount of energy that Surrey put into solving that murder was colossal. And they were a wealthier police force. They had a lot more resources, but they were absolutely tireless. Initially, obviously, they had no idea that this murder was connected with any other crimes. And their first assumption was that it was a local crime. It had every suggestion of being a local crime because, apart from anything else, the geography of the attack, because the route that Mulcahy was seen escaping from was an area which, you know, you'd have to probably know the area pretty well to even know existed. And on my first visit there myself, I couldn't even find it with a map, which just shows you just how much planning had gone into this on a kind of militaristic sort of level. So Surrey were, you know, doing all the usual things to try and solve this. But more and more people claimed to have seen this man covered in mud running for the London train, and that made them realize that this was probably not a local crime at all. And then it was at this point that the phone call came through from my dad to say, "I think we've got the same person here." The piece of wood that was lying next to the body from the Spanish windlass, Surrey assumed that that had been used as an accelerant to burning the body. But then they realized, of course, it wasn't. It was a tourniquet. So from then on, the inquiry really gathered momentum after that.
You also write about the incredible and extraordinary effort by police in this investigation. When they find this last victim, she's tied up with this course, or a kind of unusual course string. Just tell us to demonstrate
That's
the
right.
extent that the police searched for with this one bit of evidence.
Yes, that's right. It's an extraordinary thing. Marty was tied up with a very unusual piece of string. It was a paper-based string. To the police officers looking at this murder scene, there were three things that were significant. There were matches lying by the matches and tissues lying by the body. There was a piece of wood lying by the body, and there was the string the body was tied up in. Now, matches, wood, and a piece of string on their own would mean nothing. They're three items which are absolutely, you know, indistinct, aren't they? In fact, all three of them were very relevant. The tissue and matches obviously was a common trait in the rape attacks and so on. The wood for the tourniquet. The string was subjected to all kinds of tests, and it turned out to be this very unusual paper-based string called Somyarn. And only one manufacturer in the country supplied it, and it was a manufacturer in the north of England, a long way from here. It was unusual because it wasn't sold in shops. It was only sold to for industrial use. It was used mainly to tie sacks, you know, laundry bags, fertilizer bags, and that sort of thing. And what was also, it actually came from John Duffy's wife. She worked in a laundry at this point, and it was used there to tie up the laundry bags. But what was also significant was that not only was it this unusual piece of string, but the actual reel of string that Duffy had used was in itself unique. When the string came off the reelers in the factory, the bits at either end, when they're being cut, are always slightly longer or shorter than average. They're what they call end strips. And when they measured the string that had been used to tie up Marty Tambosa, they found it had indeed come from an edge strip. So the expert at the factory said, if you find the rest of this ball of string, you'll be able to match it absolutely 100% because this is absolutely unique, apart from the fact that it's 4 years old, it's not manufactured anymore, it's paper-based and so on. So they'd noted down everything from the direction of the twist of the string, the width, and so on and so forth. So they knew that if ever they found in any suspect's house, and they were going through all these endless people on this database of sexual offenders, one of the things they'd be looking for would be string. And if they found any of it, it would be subjected to rigorous forensic examination in the hope that they could do a match on it because it was unique. It was an extraordinary piece of detection. But then that's what detection comes down to in the end. It's, you know, methodical, wearing out of shoe leather and not leaving any stone unturned.
You talk next incredibly about Anne Locke, and she had just been married and came back from a honeymoon and vanished. Tell us about Anne Locke and how long it is after Marty's death.
Yes. Well, Marty died on the 17th of April, 1986. Anne Locke was killed just over a month later. 2 days after Marty died, Anne Locke was married. Anne Locke was a 29-year-old secretary who worked for a television company in London. She married a local man. She was a very well-liked, very demure lady, very respected. And she honeymooned in the Seychelles with her husband, and she came back in the second week of May 1986. And for a birthday present, her birthday was approaching, her husband decided he was going to buy her a car. So Anne sold her old car. That weekend, on the Sunday, her husband had gone away for the weekend. He was in an aqua, a sub-aqua club. She couldn't go because she was on call from work. There was a possibility of overtime. She was called on the Sunday afternoon and asked if she could come into the offices in London. She lived just outside London, in Hertfordshire, in north of London. And she would normally have driven in, being a Sunday, the traffic being quiet, but she just sold her car, so she took a train. She took a train into London, went to the office, worked on the scripts that she needed typing up, and then at about 8:30 at night, she headed for home. She was never seen again and was missing for over 2 months before she was found. And obviously at this point, there was no reason to connect her with the other crimes. The newspapers picked up on the case instantly. It was known as the missing bride story and became a media sensation. And it was a very unfortunate time. Her husband became a suspect because, you know, most murders are committed by people the victim knows. So the poor man was not only having to deal with, you know, the disappearance of his wife, but with all kinds of speculation and insinuation in the press. What had actually happened was that Duffy and McCarthy had that Sunday afternoon gone to Brookman's Park in Hertfordshire, which was Anne's local station. Again, an ideal place to commit an attack like this if you go there, because the station is bordered by countryside and you've only got a step from the platform and you're into a very concealed path with very long grass and so on. They waited around there most of the day and were seen by various people. And then in the evening, once the station guard had gone, they waited and waited. They were actually waiting for a specific victim. McCarthy had been there several times on previous Sundays and seen a girl always getting off a train with a white case, obviously someone who went away on regular trips every weekend. And that's who they were waiting for. But for some reason, that Sunday, she never appeared. And they were all set to give up when suddenly Anne stepped off the train. And they abducted her and led her the furthest distance they led any of their victims. They walked her for over half an hour through the woods. And then Duffy raped her while McCarthy kept watch. And then McCarthy told Duffy to go back to the car. And he said, take your time about it. So Duffy went back to the car on the way, rifling through Anne's handbag, stealing some money and throwing the rest of it away. McCarthy was gone for a long time, and Duffy started to get anxious and was just about to drive off looking for him when he saw McCarthy running towards the car in a very, very high state of excitement. McCarthy got in and said, let me drive. And Duffy said, what have you done? And he said, you'll see. She won't be telling anyone. And he then said, as they drove off, keep your eyes open for another one. Thankfully, there never was another one. But on this occasion, McCarthy had murdered her alone. So she was missing for weeks and weeks and weeks, and there were, you know, vast searches of the area carried out. It was a very, very hot summer. The undergrowth was so high, and police searched and searched. She was found such a long way from the station that it's hardly surprising, you know, that she was beyond the boundaries of where the search had been, you know, had been set. The search was finally called off in the middle of July, and then just after that, some railway workers did find her. By then, unfortunately, her body was dreadfully decomposed because of the time it had been outside in ferocious hot weather. My mum and dad's wedding anniversary was actually the day that Anne Locke was found. I remember my dad telephoning to say that he wasn't going to be home to take my mum out to dinner because of what had happened. And I spoke to the officer who actually drove my dad out to the scene, and he said my dad looked at the body and saw how she'd been tied up and said, that's the same man, definitely, you know. And so by now the body count was three. And Anne Locke was the last woman to lose her life to those two men.
Interesting, you talk about your father spotting Duffy in the Weld area where he thought that it was unusual that he was in that area, and he stopped and searched him. What did he find on him?
That wasn't my father, actually. That was another officer. But yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. This was a few days before the murder of Anne Locke, actually. Duffy had taken a train out to a place called North Weald, which was a long way outside London in quite a rural area. And two police officers were driving through that area on completely different matter, and one of them spotted Duffy because this officer had actually been present when Duffy had been interviewed about the attack on his wife, and he thought, I wonder what he's doing here, he's a long way from home. So they stopped him and searched him, and they found on him a knife, matches and tissue paper, which didn't mean anything to them at the time, but obviously was actually very significant later on. And they decided to take him into the police station with questioning, and they asked him why he was carrying a knife, and he said it was to cut away knots in his shoelaces, which, as excuses go, has got to be one of the less convincing ones. So he was charged with possession of an offensive weapon and put on bail. But obviously that became hugely significant later. Of course, these two officers had absolutely no idea that Duffy was involved in anything at this time other than the attack on his wife, but they did what they could, which is to... And the magistrates, when Duffy was taken to court about this, they argued that he shouldn't be bailed, that he was clearly a dangerous man, but the magistrate didn't feel that legally he could be refused bail. So he was given bail, and Locke died about 4 days later.
Let's fast forward a bit, because we have not enough time to even cover part of this incredible story. But we talked about, you mentioned the number 1594 in terms of the ACE secretors, sex offenders, the list that the police had to go through. They finally get to his number. They call him. He eventually comes in to be questioned. Tell us about this questioning and your father's rule and what it leads to.
Sure. He was the first person of all the people they'd interviewed who refused to give blood samples. And he was also the first person who came in with a solicitor as well. He insisted on having a lawyer with him. And he seemed, the two officers thought, there's something unusual about this guy. One of the things about Duffy they were struck by were these piercing blue eyes he had, this very piercing stare, which a lot of the rape victims said that the shorter man had very piercing blue eyes. He was also very, his answers were unconvincing. He was very glib and trying to be much too helpful on occasions, and then other times pleading innocence to ridiculous things. You know, like they asked him if he'd ever been in the Guildford area, which is where Marty Tambosa was killed, and he said, "Where's the Guildford area?" Which anybody who lived in the southeast of England would know. It's you know, it's a big town. It was a silly thing to say. But also, what was significant was that while Duffy was being questioned by these two officers, they then both went out of the room and said to each other, "We think that this could be him." While they're out of the room, Duffy looked down on the desk and he saw on the desk the photo fits for the North London rapists and realised that the game was up, that this could, you know, this didn't look good for him. So two things happened as a result of that meeting which were crucial. Firstly, these two officers went to their superior and said, "We've seen someone that we're not really happy with." And their boss, being a good detective, said, "Okay, I trust your judgment. We'll have a closer look at him." There were a number of things that were against Duffy. For instance, he had ginger hair, whereas a lot of the witnesses said that the shorter man had fair hair. But that's a trick of, you know, nighttime sodium lighting and so on and so forth. But they decided to look at him. What Duffy did was, as soon as he left that police station, he was in a state of panic because he knew that the police were closing in. So he went to a friend of his that he knew from martial arts training, who was a rather gullible, naive boy. And Duffy had been, for a while, probably trying to, probably use the word groom him now, actually. He would occasionally drop hints about them committing a crime together, which this boy wasn't interested in at all, but Duffy was trying. Duffy went and told him this ridiculous story that there was someone was after him. He'd stumbled across something secret and people were after him to try and silence him, and he needed to find a way out of it. So he said to this boy, "I want you to slash me with this knife and beat me up so that I can then claim that I've been mugged and I've got amnesia and don't know anything." He begged and pleaded this guy, and the guy did it. Duffy then stumbled into the local police station saying, "I've been mugged and I don't know who I am. I don't have any memory anymore." And he was taken to a local mental hospital for observation. So, of course, the following day, the police decided to take a closer interest in Duffy, found this out, and thought this was not only unlikely but also interesting. But Duffy by now was a patient in a mental hospital, so they couldn't get him out of there. Unfortunately, Duffy was an outpatient. He was free to come and go as much as he wanted. And at this point, knowing that the game was just about up, one day he left the mental hospital and raped another girl, a 14-year-old schoolgirl. And he actually said, when he abducted her, he said, "The police are after me." The police were indeed after him by now, and they put him under a prolonged period of observation. And he outwitted them a few times because he knew the railway network so well. Eventually, one night, they saw him heading towards a park in North London, obviously preparing to commit another offence, and they couldn't take any risk. So they swooped and arrested him, brought him for questioning. So he was arrested, finally, November 1986, and claimed he had no memory. He never denied these crimes, interestingly. He didn't say he did do them. He didn't say he didn't do them. He just said he couldn't remember anything. it was obvious that his amnesia was faked because the whole thing wasn't very convincing, but there wasn't much they could maneuver with it. He just wouldn't say a word. The most important question they had was, who was the other man? And Duffy wasn't saying anything. There were two reasons he wasn't saying anything. One, obviously, because he was pleading ignorance for all the crimes, but also because Duffy and Mulcahy, from the very start, had sworn a bond of allegiance to each other. They'd always sworn that if one of them was caught, they would never, ever tell on the other person. And Duffy had said to Mulcahy, if you get caught, I'll look after your family, and so on. It's an extraordinary sort of pact between them. And Duffy honoured that. But the police went to neighbours, friends, family, relatives, Duffy's wife, and so on. And it became clear very quickly that the only person really that Duffy associated with, the only person right through his life, was David Mulcahy. And when they looked at Mulcahy's description and so on and so forth, they thought this has to be the man. So Mulcahy was arrested, brought in for questioning, and was very glib, very cocksure in interview. He knew they didn't really have very much. And they put him on identity parades, and a lot of the girls didn't pick him out. They were terrified. In those days, you had to walk along a line and actually put your hand on someone. And you know, this was the man who had told them that he knew where they lived, and if anything happened, if they reported it, he would come back for them. So it was hardly surprising. But there were little bits of circumstantial evidence that gradually began to come together. Mulcahy's alibis weren't very strong, and there was various other things, descriptions. They did a massive search of his home and found weapons. They found tissues, matches. He was a non-smoker, knives, binding tape, that sort of thing. And a lot of these items were found in the cab of his van, even. But even though they tried and tried, there just wasn't enough to hold him. So, unfortunately, after extensive questioning, Mulcahy was released. And in fact, one of the police officers told me that when he went to return Mulcahy's clothes, when they came back from forensic examination, Mulcahy was standing on his doorstep laughing at them. And he said, we'll come back. I will be back knocking on this door again one day. And he just laughed. But of course they did eventually. But anyway, Duffy was prepared for trial, pleaded not guilty to everything on the grounds that he didn't know what anyone was talking about and had amnesia. Went for trial at the Old Bailey and was found guilty on all the counts of rape that he was accused of and two of the three murders. But the murder of Anne Locke, he was found not guilty of, the reason being that there was absolutely no forensic evidence at all because Anne's body was so badly decomposed. And the judge said that it would be an unsafe conviction to do that. At least there was closure on the other things. So Duffy then went down for life imprisonment in January 1988, and my dad retired from the police force, and David Mulcahy slipped back into society as a family man, and nothing more was heard of the case for nearly 10 years. And then this extraordinary final chapter occurred.
Tell us about the extraordinary and very interesting note that police put in Duffy's file.
Yes, indeed. When Duffy went to prison, there was a feeling amongst the police officers that it'll be interesting to see what a few years in prison do to him. You know, whether he will decide to come clean and, you know, spill the beans about everything. And one of the officers who had worked on the Anne Locke inquiry, Les Bolland, when he received the promotion to the point where he was able to initiate his own inquiries, he went to see Duffy in prison and asked him if he was prepared to talk. And Duffy, by this point, had a complete mental collapse. Although his amnesia was faked, by the time that it came to, you know, his parents finding out about his crimes and so on and so forth, he'd actually had a mental breakdown. And so he'd lived in prison in a kind of complete state of isolation and oblivion to everything. So this meeting with this police officer sort of triggered, you know, memories to start coming back to him. And Duffy said that it looked like Duffy might cooperate, but he was worried about the effects of revisiting his past would have on him. And he asked if he could have some sort of counseling. And so the police's attitude was a sort of softly approach on this. Duffy then began seeing a psychiatrist in prison and began talking to her. Now, she didn't know anything about the background to the case or the fact that there was another man that was still at large. But Duffy began to journey back into his past, and when it got to him talking about his school days, he mentioned David Mulcahy and revealed that they had committed these crimes together. The psychiatrist said, which prison is he in? And Duffy said, he's not in prison, he was never caught, which of course was absolutely jaw-dropping to her. So she said, look, I'm going to have to report what you've said, and Duffy was fully aware of that. So she went to Duffy's file, and there she found a note that had been left by the police to say, if John Duffy ever starts talking about his crimes, we would like to know about it. So she contacted that officer and told him what was happening and said, could you give me some more details about the case so that I can ask more? And he said, no, I can't do that. This was a very shrewd piece of maneuvering by the police. The officer said, no, I can't do that because if I start giving you information on the background to the case, in the years to come, if this ever comes to court, a clever counsel could say that I'd put words into your mouth, so I can't do it. So everything that he says will have to be done with a complete lack of knowledge on your part. Duffy then went through a very detailed set of confessions detailing everything that had happened between him and David Mulcahy. But there was an extraordinary thing that he couldn't possibly have known that was happening at the same time of this. And it really is. I mean, I said in the book that the final chapter of this case is one of the most remarkable stories in British criminal history for all sorts of reasons, and not least for this one. At the same time that Duffy was journeying back into the past, an identical series of rapes was beginning to take place in the same area of North London that he and David had operated in. The police officers working on this didn't have any knowledge of this previous case 10, 15 years ago. These attacks that were taking place were, again, stranger attacks in the Hampstead Heath area with a knife and so on and so forth, but this time it was only one man doing the attacks. They did have a DNA profile of the attacker, because by now DNA had come into forensic science. They had a DNA profile, but they had no hits on the database. It was obviously someone who didn't have a record. One of the officers, Caroline Murphy, was talking to a colleague about this and saying how frustrating it was that, you know, that there was no result. And this colleague said, I remember a case in the 80s that I worked on where there were two men, and one of them we never managed to get. I wonder if it could be him. So Caroline looked into this and came up with the name David Mulcahy, and on running a check discovered that Mulcahy lived in exactly the center of where these attacks were taking place. It looked like an open and shut case. He'd become active again, and that was it. So David was arrested, brought into the police station, and was, as ever, very, very cocky and very aggressive and very arrogant. And they asked him if he would provide a sample for DNA. And he was dismissive about it. And they asked him if perhaps he could provide some hair, which would be enough. And throughout this entire questioning, he didn't look at the female officer once. Until this point, he suddenly looked at her and basically tried to intimidate her with his stare, reached into his hair and just pulled a chunk of it out, just ripped it out at the roots. It was apparently just the most vile thing, but she thought, I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of reacting to this. So he gave her this hair, and they ran a check on it and found that it wasn't a match, that he was indeed innocent. So they had to go back and say to him, okay, all right, it's not you, off you go. And he knew he wasn't involved in it. Sometime later, the rapist was caught. It was a guy called Edward Biggs. It was just pure coincidence that Mulcahy fitted the profile of it. However, because Caroline Murphy's interest in this had made her wonder if, you know, if it had been Mulcahy operating again, now that they had DNA, they wondered if there were any exhibits left over from the 80s offences that were still around, which could now be checked for DNA. Sure enough, they found some exhibits from the 80s, and when they did a DNA check, they came out with David Mulcahy's DNA on them. And that was an extraordinary breakthrough because it was set forward by a series of coincidences. Now, of course, the DNA profile on its own would be enough to secure a conviction on one of the counts of rape. They also found fingerprints, which they hadn't had the technology to detect before, on the inside of a piece of tape. And then most important of all, they also now had the confessions of John Duffy. So Mulcahy was arrested again, and this time he really assumed that the police were clutching at straws. And when he was sat down, he was told, you're being interviewed now in connection with some offences in the 80s. And he just couldn't believe it. And then they mentioned DNA, and DNA profile had been found, and he vomited. in the police interview room in shock and realized that this was the end. The police then spent 2 years building up the case against him. It was an extraordinary inquiry. A lot of the paperwork from the 80s had been destroyed or lost. So they had to go back and track down, you know, victims. A lot of the rape victims were now living in other parts of the world. They had to track these women down and say to them, we need you to revisit this and we can't guarantee a conviction. And a lot of these women had moved on with their lives. They were now married or whatever and hadn't told their partners about this ordeal that they'd been through. It required, the amount of professionalism it required is impossible to underestimate. But it culminated in the longest murder trial in British criminal history, which ran for 4.5 months at the Old Bailey, and led eventually to an incredible result. David McCarthy was found guilty of 15 different counts, 3 murders, 7 rapes, and 5 attempted rape, conspiracies to rape, and realized on the announcement of the guilty verdicts that he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And in fact, when he came into court on the day of the announcement of the verdicts, he really thought he got away with it. He was so arrogant and so smug. And I think when the first guilty was read out, I think the blood drained from his face. And he realized the game was up. And John Duffy gave evidence against him over 14 days. It was the first time ever that a Category A prisoner had given evidence at the Old Bailey like that. And throughout that 14 days, McCarthy tried everything. He'd shout across the dock at Duffy, he would glare at him and so on. But Duffy wouldn't be swayed. He told everything. And the other thing was that Duffy actually confessed to a load more crimes, which the police hadn't been able to prove before. So the only thing that Duffy got out of it was another life sentence. And that's why McCarthy's defense didn't have a leg to stand on. They couldn't in any way suggest that Duffy was doing this to try and, you know, get his sentence reduced or anything. His sentence was doubled. It wasn't reduced, you know. So it's an extraordinary, extraordinary affair.
Yes, this is an incredible tale, too. And the satisfying conclusion of having John Duffy convicted, your father was not privy to David Mulcahy being sentenced. But in this investigation that you do for this book, and covering the footsteps that your father walked in this investigation, what was the most surprising thing, what was the most interesting thing that you discovered about your father and this investigation?
I think the most surprising thing, the most powerful thing I would say, is that when I started doing this, I wandered into this story as a bit of an innocent. I'd grown up in an atmosphere of, you know, your dad's a policeman, you know, you're sort of in that sort of world to some degree, but you never really quite understand the real horror and tragedy of these sort of things until you get that little bit closer to it like this. And what I found amazing is to cast my mind back to my childhood and think of all the times that I can see now my dad coming in from work each evening. And, you know, you're a child, you don't really think about it. When I think about what he'd spent his whole day having to deal with, and it just never showed on him at all. He had this extraordinary ability, like all policemen have to have, of just being able to close off, to just shut down, to leave his work at the office. And I couldn't do that. And I wasn't even, you know, I was only doing this secondhand, you know, I wasn't personally involved in this case or anything. But I found it really, really difficult to shut off from this. I found it extremely traumatic and very, very haunting. But he'd actually, you know, he'd been there on the ground dealing with, you know, the victims and their families and so on. So it was a remarkable resilience and mental discipline that he'd had, and which all policemen have. And it was, and I think the other thing as well like this is I hadn't realized before, it was a word I'd always taken for granted, was the word detective. But I realized by talking to so many policemen through this, just what respect they have for that word. You know, to be a policeman is one thing. To be a detective is a specific thing beyond that. And it requires a particular type of person. And he was a great detective. You know, all of the officers who were key to this inquiry were really great detectives. It's a remarkable story of detection against all odds. They were, you know, these two men were brought to justice eventually by, more than anything else, by persistent detection. So I think that would be the answer to that. I think his mental resilience and his detective skills.
Yes, it's an incredible tale, one of the most important cases in the history of Great Britain, criminal cases in Great Britain's history, and an incredible case.
I should just say, actually, the one thing the other thing that was really important about it, apart from the first time that DNA, the longest murder trial in history and so on, the other thing that's very important was the first time ever that psychological profiling had been used in a British murder investigation. It was something that was happening in America. The CIA were making inroads with it, but this was the first time in Britain it had been used. And obviously that's gone into a lot more in the book as well. But there's so much work has been done in that field today, and we know so much more is known about that. At the time, this was unheard of in Britain, and proved to be very, very significant.
Yes, and it's also, you chronicle sort of a form of geographical profiling as well as the criminal profiling.
Yes.
That it seemed to be far above, ahead of itself with this police force and its and its techniques and efforts. I want to thank you very I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about A Dangerous Place, the story of the railway murders, and the story of your father, and the Great Britain's most important, one of the most important cases. For those that might want to look at your other work, or if there's a Facebook page, how could people contact you or find out more about your work?
I do a blog, actually, which people could look up. I do a blog called Dreams Gathering Dust, which is just a space to talk about stories of all sorts. There's some crime things on there, because this did actually ignite a bit of an interest in true crime anyway. So that's probably the best place, and I can be contacted through that as well. I've been very, very moved by the reaction that this book's got, because the most important thing for me was to do the story justice, not just to my father, but to all the officers who worked on it, and all to all the people who were personally affected by it. And we've been nominated for the Gold Dagger Award for the Crime Writers Association, which is very satisfying. That's really nice, because it's a nice sort of thing to have. But I'm glad I did it regardless of that, because it was important for me, and it is a story that I do think is important to be remembered.
Absolutely, and I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about A Dangerous Place, the story of the railway murders, Simon Farquhar. Thank you very much. An incredible book, and thank you for this interview. Have a great day.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.